So the real winner here is just whoever owns the billboard and has convinced both car dealerships to bid against each other, because it's like, well, now that this billboard is up, like, you got to spend the money. I put the billboard up.
It's a prisoner's dilemma situation.
And now this is your problem, right?
Well, then it gets hilarious again, because like, as anybody who's gone to GDC before as a developer, you can't throw a rock without hitting an advertisement company, a new one. Right.
I wish I could throw rocks.
Scotch. Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 293 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast of Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I do web stuff.
I'm Sam, and I'm the artist.
And this is a show where we talk about life, business, and working in the games industry. Today is January 8th, 2021. Dunk on everyone. Before we get started, we have a warning. This podcast will have profanity in it, so just know that that's coming. We'd also like to thank our supporters over at moneygrab.bscotch.net. We got a new recurring supporter, Consu Labs, who left us a message. Been loving your podcasts for such a long time, I felt like it was time to let you grab some of my money. Keep up the great work in 2021.
Thanks. It was about time, to be honest. You know, I was checking the calendar there. I was like, wow.
They're like, Consu Labs. This is
haven't seen my payment, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and we'd also, of course, like to thank all of our recurring supporters. It's we appreciate you guys helping us keeping our mic tubes lubey. So we wanted to kind of spend a lot of time on questions today, just really go to town on those things. But we did have a little kind of exciting announcement about where we're at with some studio stuff.
More exciting for us than everybody else, but we're going to say it anyway because we're excited about it.
Well, yeah, so last year we had this, you know, we called it our tech debt burndown rodeo circus, which was converting all of our games from Bscotch ID over to Rumpus. And then like the minute we finished that, GameMaker 2.3 came out, which is a whole new version of GameMaker. Has a bunch of new features in it and also a bunch of new sort of like compatibility stuff.
And also broke all of our tools because all of our tools relied on the prior way that everything worked.
Yeah. So all of a sudden we're like, yay, we're done. We're done with resolving our tech debt problems. And then Yo-Yo Games was like, did you say tech debt? And then they gave us a bunch of tech debt.
And importantly, the reason we needed to do it was because if we have to maintain our games across two different versions of GameMaker, then that's exactly the point where you end up having like just a tremendous amount of extra work created over time, even though in a moment it's much easier to be like, well, it's just
yeah,
not, right?
I mean, I'm sure some of our listeners have had experiences. Maybe you've worked in an office, or maybe you do work in an office where they have like a Windows XP certain patch that they're running for all of their computers. Because they're like, do not download a Windows update. Do not patch anything. Don't download anything. Don't touch anything. Because if you do anything with this computer, everything our entire works. System will collapse.
Or people using, you know, Citrix, which required Internet Explorer version like 8 or below. Because I remember our mom, when she would have to like log in remotely to do her remote work, and because she had to deal with like patient information and stuff. You know, it's got to be all secure. So I have to use these like – so they have to use this like very specific tech to get access that's been like approved by a jillion bureaucrats, and they're spending, you know, a jillion dollars a year on and all of this kind of stuff. But then it's always something like, use this exact ancient version of Internet Explorer, and if you do anything else, then the whole thing does not
work. The company's going under. Yep. You know, if you use Internet Explorer 8.7, then you know the SEC is going to get involved. Billions of dollars will be lost.
Yeah, you're done for life.
It's over. Mm-hmm. Yep. And so you're probably going to jail, honestly. So that's, you know, we want to avoid that situation. And it's honestly it's pretty nice to make these updates, as sort of nerve-wracking and terrible as it is, but it reminds me a lot of moving. Like if you move apartments or house or whatever,
it's horrible.
It's terrible, but at the same time, it's kind of awesome because you get everything out there, everything out in the open.
You get to rethink everything.
You rethink everything. You see all your stuff in boxes, and you're like, "Why do I have all? Why do I have all this garbage?" You get to reimagine a new future for yourself, and then, I mean, ultimately, you end up being the same person, just in a different house or whatever. Mm-hmm. But there's a moment there where it's very exciting.
And also, ultimately, you put most of that stuff in the basement and never touch it again.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you thought it was really important that you keep it.
Yeah, and it wasn't. Yeah. Yeah. But so doing these big software transitions is a lot like that, where for us to convert from Bscotch ID to Rumpus, you know, we had to go back through all the old game code and look at what it was doing and decide, like, do we need to keep this? And sometimes we're like, yeah, we should keep this, but then it ends up going in the basement and it turns out it doesn't matter anyways. But, you know, so this GameMaker 2.3 change kind of started around like October.
It was – I think it was literally like the week that we finished the Rumpus update. We immediately went straight into the 2.3 update.
And so we had to update all of our tools, update all of our games. And then we all had to give a shout out to the Yo-Yo Games team, who was very receptive and collaborated with us on resolving some of the sort of like edge case issues with the new GameMaker version.
Because we're always – it turns out we're using GameMaker differently than – the average GameMaker user. And so every time we update to anything, we're like, hey, Yo-Yo, here are 1,000 bugs that we need to know immediately. Yeah.
And they're like, wow, nobody else has seen these. We're like, yeah, we've seen all of them though, like immediately. So so they've been great with getting updates out and getting those things fixed. And so we hit a point now where right before we went for our winter break, we got all the games updated. And now finally, as of roughly now, all of those updates are out. So Bscotch ID transition is done. GameMaker 2.3 transition is done, which means we're starting 2021 in this really nice place where we get to focus on the future and not worry so much about all of this tech debt stuff. So that means 2021 is kicking off with just tons and tons of time pouring into Crashlands 2, where we can focus very intensely on that. As well as now take a look at some of the tooling that we have now that it's all up to date, and just work on new tech to make things run more smoothly. Mm-hmm. So very excited about that. And if you are playing Crashlands on the Switch, you may have noticed that it was still using Bscotch ID. That's because the Switch version kind of got caught in that moment where we had finished the Bscotch ID transition, but started the GameMaker 2.3
and then it didn't transition. Make it through CERT.
So it didn't make it through.
Failed CERT, but we'd already started the 2.3 transition, and we didn't want to go back and like, oh, let's just fix all this stuff in a separate place, like in the past on its own branch. Like we didn't want to deal with it.
So
3 months later.
You'll be getting the Rumpus version of Crashlands on the Switch pretty soon. So very excited about all that stuff. And now it's just blue skies. Mm-hmm. Ahead.
We have a beautiful year.
Yeah. All right. Are we ready for some questions?
Yeah.
All right. All right. Highest upvoted question from podcast.bscotch.net comes from Mimabip Gorky, who says, what's your work break strategy? How many hours do you work before taking a break, and for how long? What do you do during your breaks? Do you change the kind of work you do toward later parts of the day, and have you found the certain break activities rejuvenate you more than others?
I think we all have different strategies here. Mine is the least, or at least is unstructured, so I'll just go first. It's basically, if I start feeling hungry or have low blood sugar, I take a break. If at some point I'm like, I really want something to drink, then I take a break and I go get some tea or something, or some coffee or whatever. And that's my entire strategy. And then if I'm working with somebody, in particular if I'm working with Seth, then if one of us remembers to take a break because we haven't peed for like 5 hours and one of them about to have our bladders explode, then we both go limping off into the distance to go take a break and relieve our poor bladders, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's my whole strategy.
Yeah, I got a pretty unstructured I think strategy is maybe a pretty bold word for it, but I think there's something that I've noticed about breaks, which I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on this, but I think taking a break can actually be a problem if you do the wrong thing on the break.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
So this is it comes to the question of break activities. So I found that if you take a break and then you like wash dishes or go for a walk, or like just do something that's kind of like where you're not actively focused on the task that you're doing, then that allows you to kind of like churn through the problem that you're taking a break from. It allows you to kind of make connections and discover things.
Right? Yeah, well, you don't have to destroy the mental model that you had previously assembled of your problem.
If on your break you read a book or watch a YouTube video or something like that, then suddenly you've completely diverted your attention to some new thing, and you will return from your break disoriented. And
now it's harder to get back to work.
And it's harder to get back to work.
Yeah, so I think it depends on the type of work, though, because mine's also true with the art stuff, because like, I don't have to hold a mental model in my head because it's
the model's on the paper
there. So I've actually found it super useful to engage in the more distancing activities. So like reading a book for 10 minutes or 15 minutes. I've done some of the daily challenges for Monster Train has been my favorite like way to take a break because it's like 30 minutes tops. And I play the game so much now that I was like, it's basically an automated thing. It's kind of like doing the dishes, right? So it's slow to make decisions and stuff, but it's kind of fun and it loosens me up. And typically when I get back from that activity, it's somehow easier to do stuff again, if that makes sense. Because it kind of like fully disconnect and then get back into it.
That is true. So you have to have respect for the kind of work that you're doing and what you're taking a break from. Because I mean, it's always the case that like a break is a break, right? Like if you're – a break is you just sort of – distancing yourself from the work. So in all respects, it's a successful break, right?
Well, yeah.
no matter what you do.
Well, it depends on your goals for the break. Because the other part of the question is, why are you taking a break? Are you taking a break because like it's noon and that's the reason? And like noon is when you take a break? Like, you know, any reason is fair, right? Like just – why are you doing it? Because that's what determines your success. Because if your goal is to take a break and like disconnect from work completely and do something completely different, and that is the purpose of the break, then it just is the case that for certain kinds of work, it's just going to be harder when you get back, right? Mm-hmm. And like that's an okay strategy if that's the goal. My goal for breaks though is always to during the workday is to minimize their impact on the subsequent parts of my work, and so I try to structure it around that.
Yeah, I typically try. I pick activities that I know are useful given the context of the work I'm doing. But as far as like my break strategy, it's very similar to what Seth said, which is essentially whenever a biological need becomes apparent, then I'll go sort of take care of that. I always have, as everyone in the studio can attest, because my mugs used to be visible to everybody in the studio. Mm-hmm. Now they are not, luckily, because of
Sam would accumulate up to six mugs. Mm-hmm. Before he'd suddenly look down and be like, this is a lot of mugs, and then have to go, you know, take care of all of them.
So now I typically, like when I come upstairs, I'll typically come up the stairs from any given kitchen run bringing at least two beverages. It's usually a cup of water, so basically something cold and something hot, a cup of water and a cup of tea. And then at some point I'll try to drink one of them, it'll be empty. And then I'm like, okay, I'll move on to the next one. As soon as that's empty, then it's time to, you know, go do it again.
But not take them downstairs, but to just go downstairs.
Oh, no, I do actually
get two more mugs. Things.
Okay. Yeah, because it's for whatever reason, it's somehow easier to do in the house than it was in the office. But then I think beyond that, like I noticed, and this is actually an interesting thing from the holiday break that we just got off, which I think my natural work cadence is actually something around like from about 10 until maybe 1 or so is like usually like an optimal time. And then there's actually like usually a good like 2 hour chunk where I just don't like after I do one big piece of work where it's actually far better for me to go like just literally just go do something else for an extended period of time. And then over the break, what would typically happen is I would get back from that anywhere from 2 to 4 and then work again until 7 or 8. And for whatever reason, like I think that's actually sort of the natural cadence I have.
It's like the siesta model. You know, you're gonna work hard for a while, then you're gonna really like detach.
Just go do some other stuff for a bit. Yeah. So actually, I do really like that model. Like, it's obviously the one that I naturally fall into, and I'm just sort of up to my own devices. The rough part about that, of course, is I think the reality is you have to somehow try to mesh your natural tendencies into whatever structure you have for office or studio life that works, that somehow like hopefully works best for like the group on average, right?
Yeah. The reality is that everyone has sort of a different way of doing things, different goals, different natural behaviors, all that kind of stuff. And so you cannot have one system that just does work well for everybody.
Yeah. It's like we don't keep track of people's breaks. We don't tell people to take lunch at certain times or whatever else. The stuff we do is we start at the same time so we can get everybody oriented. And then we have our stand down at the same time because we found from doing remote work that people tend to just keep on working, which, you know, as a business, you're like, yeah, until everyone burns out and then wants to leave after like 3 months. So we're like,
well, I think actually that's a side effect or like that's a side effect of the time stand down. I think it's mostly that in the same way, the morning getting oriented and the evening also getting oriented, right? Of being like getting everybody back on board. Cause I think the thing that felt bad in outside of the context of an office was the fizzling out of people slowly disappearing when they were never really there in the first place. It just felt worse, just, you know, because
yeah. Well, not only that, but like it, by having a very concrete thing where it says where you're sort of announcing like the work day is done now, mm-hmm. right? Then you've created an invitation for people to go home.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. So, that's a nice thing, also. But I think the original purpose for it was not that. It just has that really nice outcome that I think now in retrospect we're like, oh yeah, this is actually a sufficient reason to do it.
Because if you don't have that ritual of declaring the workday over, then now it moves. It's almost like I'm sure people have worked in companies where. Where you get vacation days, but then they make you feel guilty for taking them, right? Right. And it's that same kind of thing, which is like, yeah, I mean, technically the workday is 9 to 5, but also like we're going to look very favorably on you if you stay until 5 a.m. instead of 5 p.m., yep. you know, because you're a real hard worker.
Well, it's the same thing with breaks, right? I mean, people tend to not take breaks for that same reason, which is crazy because when you look at the actual productive output, like it goes up when people can take the damn breaks they need, right? The quality goes up, productivity goes up.
Yeah, I think there's a speed limit on getting good work done. Mm-hmm. Like everybody's got sort of like a certain amount of stuff that they're able to get out in a day in like a reasonable way without destroying themselves. And it just kind of expresses itself differently. Mm-hmm. Our next question comes from Captain Jazz. Imagine a future where jobs no longer exist. Mm-hmm. What would people do with their time?
Just jobs don't exist, as in like you don't get paid to do things or there's nothing you can do anymore.
Jobs.
I think probably my guess is it means like, there's
it's like a thing you have to do to get by.
Correct. So I think we have to –
universal basic income is sort of the
– Well, we have to sort of like – we have to structure this future in a way that the jobs no longer need to exist, right? Because right. Like, we all need to
– all the jobs.
It's got to be robots, right? But also the robots need to be smart enough that
– they have to make more robots and take care of
that
themselves.
Robots are maintaining the other robots,
right?
Because like we need food. We need to get the food into cities. You need to be able to like go to a restaurant. Well, the restaurant needs to be entirely staffed by – robots.
Mm-hmm. And the food
has to be – because there's no jobs.
Right. And the food has to be free because we can't have money at all, because if we have money, now there are jobs. So
– yeah. This is and if you need to get somewhere, then you – I guess you just – a robot takes you there somehow.
Yeah. Right? And robots are the government because otherwise the government requires jobs.
Right, because that's a job. So we're being ruled by robots.
Yeah.
And also – so I guess in this world, like everyone is just purely a consumer.
Yeah.
Because nobody I guess
you don't have to be a consumer. You can still create and share.
The point is you just can't get paid.
You just can't get paid to do it. So
is that what makes something a job?
I think what makes something a job probably in this context is going to be the need to show up to something in order to survive.
Well, I think it's also the transactional nature too, right? It's like, yeah, so first of all, you have to do it because you get money in exchange.
Uh-huh.
But also you do it at least in part because you get money in exchange. Where for now at post jobs, you can't get money in exchange. Otherwise, it's a job, right? And you can't have to do it. Otherwise, it's a job. So that means that now every single waking moment of your life is just things you are opting into. And the world around you is structured using robots in such a way that whatever whim you want – actually, this isn't even true. It could be that you don't actually get to have the things that you want. There's no way to get it with money or – mm-hmm. You know, with work, right? So this doesn't mean we're in a utopia necessarily, right?
You know, all this means is that you actually have to structure things in a way that people will want to do the thing that you need them to do, and you have to just treat them well.
But without also exchanging something, there can't be exchange.
Well, so this actually makes me think a lot of an MMO guild. because of course nobody's getting paid to run these things, but they put like 40 plus hours a week into just like the organizational side of, of managing these giant groups of people. And the only thing anybody's getting out of it is like digital in-game achievement, you know, check marks.
I think this is true for a lot of online communities and content, right? Is that most of these things are fandoms or any of this kind of stuff. It's all community run and no one's getting paid and no one has to do it, you know?
Yeah. And there's like this one guy who's responsible for most of Wikipedia, you know? I don't know if you guys knew that. So I think – because imagine like what if you wanted to go to space? If you wanted to go to space in this world where there's no jobs, right? So you would have to acquire all the materials to build the rocket. You would have to convince enough people to design it and coordinate the mission, et cetera, et cetera. But all of this would have to be done purely by people
who just want to do it,
who just are pumped about the idea and just want to do it and got nothing else going on.
But I guess this is, this is what I think is the interesting thing. It doesn't seem like too much of a leap for me, which is that I think a lot of the stuff that people do, they would still do.
Yeah. Because this actually comes back to people. The idea of bullshit jobs is what this question is really about, right? Because at root, this is a question about universal basic income, which I'm all for.
And what humanity is all about, which like, believe it or not, stuff. People have been around doing stuff far longer than there was an economy paying you for it in any sort of meaningful way, right? So
and
we are programmed to do cool stuff and to create stuff and whatever else. Yeah, it's just this bullshit jobs question, which is a job to me. That's what a job is.
But I think the hard part comes when trying to – like if we move away from this like robot world – right, which is like, okay, let's say it's today. We don't have sophisticated robots to take care of everything. Money is not a motivator because people just do the things that they want to do, right?
Sure.
So there are a lot of jobs that are super dangerous and super hard. And the big reason that people will do them is just because they need the paycheck and the money's good enough to compensate for that. So maybe that's something like, you know, mining coal or, you know, something that's just like real fucking hard.
But the thing is, when you look at these jobs that actually are dangerous or jobs that people don't want to do, the pay does not match up with that actually. Like in terms of – I don't know when one wants to do it, but also the pay doesn't make up for the amount that people don't want to do it, if that makes sense. Like,
oh, yeah.
No, people are underpaid generally in those job scenarios, right?
People are generally underpaid, but it's
– Actually, a lot of those jobs pay quite well actually because – it's either that there aren't any other jobs in the area, right? So this is just like your option.
This is what you do, yeah.
But it's that they do pay enough because if people have other options, you know, they're not going to choose the one that kills you, right? And so they don't have other options for some reason. That's either because there just literally aren't any, right, or because this is the most viable one based on the compensation mechanism, right? So can you have? Can you – because not having jobs doesn't mean there's no compensation. It just means that compensation isn't required. Currency. It's not like
– So okay. So a job is basically defined as like something you have to do for money, something you have to do to get by, which is very different from work, right? Yeah. So the idea is then if you have a universal basic income where everybody gets at least enough money that they – don't have to worry about whether they're going to get by, right? I don't know.
If you want more, you still have to do a job.
You still have to go do a job, yeah. Because the hedonic treadmill is real. Yeah. Like you're gonna be like, yes, I do have food and shelter and safety and healthcare and stuff like that. But also, like, I do want some really nice boots. You know, like I want more than just what I have because I'm a person.
There's a huge difference between jobs not existing and you not having to do a job.
Yeah, because you needing to do a job is at some point in this world going to be commensurate with what your goals are, which are always increasing because you're a person, you know?
Yeah. I don't think there's a universe where jobs don't exist. I don't think that's a thing.
Yeah, I think it would just be the case that even if your needs are all met, I think – people like doing stuff. Yeah. Yeah. And you always want more stuff. So like
Well, not only that, but like I've seen countless times where somebody who is highly qualified in a competitive field ends up sticking around at a job that they actually hate just because of like maybe the money is good enough, maybe – and they don't need it, you know, because they're in a very high-paying job or something. But like – and if they change to another office or something else, maybe they take a slight pay cut. It'd be a much better environment, but they just don't. Because also, like, they've got a few friends there that they don't want to abandon.
It's like gravity.
There's a lot of reasons why people like stick around at a job that they actually don't enjoy. They don't even necessarily have to do with money, right? Like, people are sticky. They kind of get into a thing and they just kind of stay there for a while. So I don't know.
Yeah. I think there is no world where there are no jobs unless we live in an AI and robot-led utopia where all of our needs can always be met and we're all basically the equivalent of hedonic bajillionaires of today, right? I think that's the world in which jobs don't exist. The world in which jobs aren't required is now like universal basic income that is sufficient for you to have a decent quality of life, right? And not worry about your future. And in that world, now the question is like, then what do you do, right? Because now you don't have to do anything. And I think Sam is right, which is people will still do stuff. Like there will be some people, of course, always that are just like, this is sufficient for me.
And they'll still do stuff that they don't like because there's a difference between like having what you need to get by and having what you need in order to meet some predefined sort of idea of what you want your life to be, you know? Mm-hmm. And oftentimes that comes down to money. So you'll have people in these very high paying professions. Maybe we're talking like dentists, lawyers, you know, whatever. Where their compensation is great, but also a lot of them have a really bad time,
and they work really most bad of their lives actually.
Yeah, where the stress of that kind of work is just a lot, and people have a lot of issues with it, you know. But they'll just keep doing it because they want the money, and they've decided that having that money at that high of a level is what they need in order to achieve some
because it actually other. I mean, other I think needs, what you're saying right? that it is basically that there are like once you get out of the middle class kind of level where the future is always uncertain and all that kind of stuff, right? That once you get beyond that, those people who are there already are basically doing optional jobs, right? Because
they don't need as much as they have.
Right.
Yeah. But they will keep doing it.
They will
despite how hard it is for them and how bad it is for their health and their mental health and everything else, because they want it.
Yeah,
they want the outcome.
Yeah, so those are the answers, I guess. In short, you can't have no jobs unless we have benevolent robot AIs, or unless they're not benevolent and our lives just suck. That's the other possibility.
Yeah, people can never be satisfied.
Yeah. Or if you didn't have to have jobs, it would look exactly like it does today, but we would just have – people would be happier and more comfortable and healthier. Everything would be great, and then there would still be a bunch of people who have a fuckload of money because, you know – because capitalism.
People. Next question comes from Butterscotch Atheist, who says, I hate seeing advertisements.
Same.
But I also understand that they're, on some level, a fundamental part of capitalism. What's your relationship with advertising? Do you have any contradictory ideologies like this? So I've gone all over the map on this over my time as a – so obviously as a consumer, I hate them. I hate seeing them.
Right? Yeah, well, I was gonna say which part? Because
they're just in the way. Like I want to see a thing, but I don't get to see that.
Instead,
I don't get to see that thing.
It's a constant bait and switch, you know.
Yeah, and I've often thought about the places where we've allowed advertisement to creep. Like, hey, have you guys ever tried to read any article on your phone?
Oh yeah, it's a nightmare.
Because it's always like, here's six sentences. Okay, time to scroll past seven giant full screen ads and like six more sentences and more full screen ads, right? And
you say people, on your phone because you don't have ad block on your phone, I assume.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Um, But even if you say like, you know, I don't want to, you know, I know that like sites earn their money from advertisements, so I don't want to run an ad blocker, and they're egregious about it. You know, it's just sometimes you'll have a site where like you'll go to the site and you won't see anything because there's a giant full screen ad that you then have to scroll completely down past to get to the website. And it's interesting that's just a matter of course for certain kinds of content. But like, let's say you went to watch a play in person, right? And every 3 to 4 minutes, they would pause the scene and some person would run out onto the stage and start telling you about this amazing new bleach.
You mean you're literally describing the original soap opera, the definition. Because you know that the reason that soap operas are called soap operas is because they were televised plays and they would come in and sell soap in the middle of it. Right.
Yeah.
That's why it was called a soap opera. So you're just describing, like, you're describing something that as if it's fantastical and absurd, but that is how how TV came to be. Was it started as a play and they were like, how do we monetize this? Oh, let's sell soap in the middle of it. Right. And now there you go.
Yeah. But, you know, like there are certain places where nowadays, like you don't see that. Right. And you don't see that in like a book. It wouldn't be like, okay, now that this chapter is done, we're going to have a chapter where we tell you about soap and then go back to the main story of the book, right? Maybe we'll get there.
We are at the place where if you buy a Kindle, an Amazon Kindle, you have two options. One is you can get the one with ads for 20 fewer buckaroonies, or you can get the one without ads. And if you get the one with ads, then just when the screen is off, like when you don't have the Kindle running, you know, and you're about to boot it up, it's just showing you a random fucking advertisement. So they don't put it in the book.
Yet, it's just on the
but it's
Kindle.
On the Kindle.
Yeah, but I find it. I think it's all context based because there's actually so I despise them in this way we're talking about, which is when they're in the way for a thing that you are knowingly trying to get to. So, but the pre-roll before a YouTube video, you know, popping into like read a news article, or like see a news article or a newsreel of some sort. And there's like a minute long Honda ad that you cannot skip before you get to, I'm done. Like I'm leaving. Right. Mm-hmm.
Because like half of all pages in a magazine are ads. And so like you can't trying to find something that's actual content, you know,
but Sam, did you buy the Honda though? Because if you did, then it worked. Okay.
So, yeah, but I think that the context is really important because I think these ones that like interrupt stuff are the thing that we're always talking about. And everyone's, I think, always comes off my mind when it's like, how much do you hate ads, right? But actually, there's been an interesting sort of a switch for me because I've been using Instagram, right, a little bit. And because I'm not looking for something in particular, right, because I'm essentially browsing, you're sort of scrolling through some stuff. And the ads look exactly like content. And because they're targeted, and very effectively, might I add, it's always for games on Kickstarter, cool, weird-ass gadgets and stuff, and then like other just like cool things that I actually am interested in as a person on like a general product category level. And so
what I see is all interesting cat things. Mm-hmm. It's cat things and tattoo things because that's all that I look at on my Instagram. Yeah,
it's a weirdly enough, like Instagram is the only place where I do find myself actually looking at the ads for one and then being like, huh. Like I probably like once a week I'll click through on something and go kind of read about whatever the fuck the thing is, right? And I don't mind it at all for some reason. I think it's because of the browsing context. I'm not trying to get to a place and they're not interrupting me. They're just sort of inserting. Yeah,
you're already looking at random shit. You don't even know what's coming.
Exactly.
So who cares? Exactly. Who cares if you get random shit that's an advertisement?
Yeah. Yeah. It somehow works out just fine. And then of course,
so the question I have about ads though, from that viewpoint, because there's a really interesting two-part Freakonomics episode called. It's just called "Does Advertising Actually Work?" Mm-hmm. And they, of course, they talk to a lot of people from the advertising industry who were like, of course. And then they talk to CEOs who were like, well, we spent a lot of money on it, so I'd like to think so. And then they talk to statisticians who are like,
nope,
there's no way to know, right?
Which is the right answer.
The fundamental question there is what's the cost benefit, right? Because advertising is expensive, and if it works as well as people think, like claim that it does, then it's worth the money. But in order for an ad to be effective, it would have to convince someone who was otherwise unconvinced to do something that they otherwise weren't going to do.
The idea of advertising is you're printing money, right? Because you spend some of the money to advertise, and then you make more money off of that because people wouldn't have bought it, and now
they would not have bought it.
And then you come out in the black as a consequence of doing it.
Yeah. So like, let's say you're a candy bar manufacturer. You've got your delicious candy bar. You make it. It's amazing. You market test it. It's called Slammers. Mm-hmm. Yep. So you've got your Slammers. Because people slam them into their mouths because they're so good, right? Mm-hmm. So you take your packaging is very interesting and cool, and it stands out next to the other candy bars. You've market tested it. The flavor is great. People love it. And you've worked with all of these grocery stores and gas stations and whatever to get that candy bar placed right there by the register, you know? So you can maximize on that impulse buy thing, right? So now that you've lined up all those dominoes, the one final thing is like, if for you to justify spending money on advertising, that now has to be the thing that like moves somebody from definitely not buying your candy bar into definitely buying the candy bar, right? Mm-hmm. The problem is you just don't know.
There's absolutely
no way to know which people those are. There's a common quote that people in marketing point to, which is I think CEO or marketing guy from, I don't know, early 1900s or something, who was like, half of my money that I spend on advertising is wasted. The problem is I don't know which half.
Well, this is the dream of targeted advertising, right? Is that you find those people based on their interests and whatever, and you show them the right ad at the right time so that
– But again, it's people – because – and this is where targeted advertising even becomes even weirdly harder to justify, because it's like, here's somebody who I am confident is interested in buying a new car, right? Because of some aspect of that I've been able to target using my algorithms, I'm pretty confident that this person is going to buy a new car. You show them the ad for your car, and for that money to have been worth it, that person wasn't going to consider buying your car. They weren't going to buy the car, and now they are going to buy your car instead of any of the other options.
And by that person, you mean a high enough fraction of those people to offset the cost of you spending money targeting all of those people because of the very high markup. So in the case of like a car or a mattress or whatever, the markup is so high, you can spend a fuckload of advertising dollars before you are – in order to break you. So I think this is actually the crux of it, is that depending on what you're selling and who you're selling to, because if you're trying to sell a candy bar costs a few bucks, right? So like –
Your margin is tiny.
If you're trying to sell a mobile game, a premium mobile game, again, a few bucks, right? The margin is very tight. If you're trying to sell an indie title for maybe 20 bucks, it's still pretty tight because advertising is very expensive. Mm-hmm. If you're now selling an $80, a $60 AAA title with 10 DLCs, each one that's 20 bucks, and then infinite in-app purchases, right? Then like, okay, now you got a really wide margin here before – your spend doesn't or can't possibly result in actually printing money.
But it's also possible that you just threw the money away.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm pretty confident that for Levelhead, all of our advertising money was basically thrown away.
And I think that's probably true of most advertising money in most cases, probably. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm even thinking about like one thing we know is a Candy Crush. You know, they spent $500 million a year on advertising, right? And they're pretty well convinced that that is how they are able to sustain their revenues, right? It's actually hard to say though whether or not having spent that money is what allowed them to stay there or not, right? Because you can't split the universe. Like there's no other universe where they just didn't spend that money and stayed at the top of the charts, because they did spend that money It's spent now.
Yeah, I think to me, all this stuff comes back to this basically this weird place you get to when you're making a product where you're like, I need to tell people about this. I do need to let people know that this exists. And there's this thing called advertising where you pay to get in front of people to show them that this thing exists.
That's the purpose.
But all of the data and all the studies, by and large, can't actually say with a degree of certainty that that thing by itself will be a profitable thing for you to do.
Right, or that letting people know about your product via the mechanism of ads is the thing that will allow you to, you know, print money.
But you're still the point where you're like, well, what the fuck else does one do then?
Well, that's exactly it is you don't have other options. Well, actually, that's not true. You do have other options. This is where going to conventions. This is one of the ideas that people have. Like, if I show my game at a convention so that there's, you know, thousands of people who walk by it or that certain people who have influence walk by it or whatever. Same deal with like having somebody play your game on a stream. It's mm-hmm. This is all the same idea, right? Which is these are all these different channels by which you can get people's eyeballs on your product with the goal of those being the right eyeballs on the right product that it results in people buying it. There's only one you can control, which is spending money on advertising.
Yeah.
And that's actually the reason I think that advertising is so popular and so common is because it is. And we even think about this with Levelhead, right? We got no coverage of Levelhead by the press at all, right? And also no streamers. The one thing that we had control over and that worked in the sense that people saw it was we spent money on YouTube ads in particular, right? But ads in general. So the only reason that we were able to show Levelhead to people ourselves on purpose was by spending ad money. But on the other hand, the only places it really seemed to matter was when the storefront showed it to people, which we didn't have to pay for, right? So, but those weren't guaranteed. Those could have not happened. And so I think this is why advertising is so popular. And we just kind of all assume that it's doing something is because it is the one thing that we can control.
Directly do. Yeah. That's right. It's almost more, I think you should think about it more like an insurance policy for being able to say with some degree of certainty that you were able to make sure some people saw your product.
Right. It's not an insurance policy in the sense that
– for selling at all.
It works, right? Right. Yeah. But in the sense that – and I think there's this general thing that we all have, which is the idea that we have to do something, right? Like we that if we don't do something, then we're failing in some way, right? And there's some scenarios in which there is nothing that can be done, right, that actually moves mm-hmm. things forward. But still, the natural human behavior is to do something anyway.
Right? That's why, like, a lot of surgeries are necessary for this exact reason, right? It's like you mm-hmm. You can't actually like fix this or really do much about it, but it feels better somehow to like
to say act. Like I did what I could. I did what I could. Yes. You know?
Yeah.
But I think
this is a placebo effect, right? Because like we already went on a rant a few episodes ago about fake medicine, right? But it's the same. It's the same deal, right? It's like. It's you might even know that the stuff that you're taking is bullshit, right? And is not real medicine, but you felt like you did something, right? And the fact is that doing something has a placebo effect, which for people is great. For a business that doesn't do jack shit, right? it's easy to confuse these things.
Yeah, in the Freakonomics episode, they kept coming back to this mantra that like so many people were saying, which is this like if advertising didn't work. Then why would so many companies be spending so much money on it?
It's mm-hmm. very which is a, way to look at
which
it.
Is a very silly thing to say. Yeah.
Well, there's also an explanation for it that isn't related to its effectiveness, which is the arms race aspect. So one thing you'll notice mm-hmm. if you do ever find yourself spending money on advertising, one of the things that will be recommended to you, either by the software that's doing it or by the people that you talk with, is to directly advertise against your competitors. So that when you're let's take Levelhead, right? We could pay Google or whoever to say, hey, when people search for Mario Maker, show them Levelhead, right? We can pay to do that. And they will encourage us to do that because on the one hand, that drives up like – that fucking drives up like crazy how much everybody has to pay for advertising, right? Because now we're in a bidding war to get those eyeballs because, you know, obviously Nintendo doesn't care about us. They're not going to – that's not a real thing. But in a context where that was happening, you now have two companies both trying to make sure the other one doesn't steal its eyeballs. And you see this constantly. Like every time you do a Google search and then you like for some product and then the top top sponsored results are competitors of that product. This is by design, right? And we even had this when we first started trying advertising on the App Store. One of the things that we were like, oh yeah, you should also be using, like, when people are, you should use Crashlands. So we were trying it with Crashlands. They were like, you should use Crashlands as a term.
Yeah, use it for your own name too, to make sure no one else can show up.
Right. And then the stupid thing about it was then we're looking at our advertising results and we're like, oh, actually this is really effective because we can actually see we can see people clicking on our ads and actually then buying the game, right? Except almost every single person who did that was searching for Crashlands, right?
Because again, an ad is only worth the money if it convinces somebody to act who otherwise wasn't going to already.
Or in the case of now what it's used for, it's for business warfare, right? So now it can be useful if it prevents somebody from going to your competitor, right?
Yeah. And so I think this is where a lot of
it comes from.
If you say like, there's like 6 billboards in my town and I've got a car dealership and, you know, Steve on the other side of town, he's got a car dealership.
And now you each bid to get on that billboard.
If Steve gets all the billboards and suddenly everybody's going to know about his car dealership, they're not going to know about my car dealership, which is, you know, maybe, right?
Well, and there's truth to this. Like some of these things are effective, right? Because – and this is also why, you know, car dealerships stamp their name on the back of everybody's cars when they sell them to you, right? Is because like – especially like going around St. Louis, there's a handful of those that I've seen a million times, right? Mm-hmm. So now it is the case that if I go Google like, oh, should I do need a new car? And I'll go Google it. The one that I recognize is the one I'm going to click on first. That is what is going to happen, right?
So probably not, though. Probably the one that they have paid to be at the top of your search results.
That's true. Right? So I don't think it's fair to say that like this stuff doesn't work or anything. I think it's that it's a lot more nuanced, right? And I think that the fact that – because the crux of all of this is that there are finite – like that people's attention is a finite resource, right?
Yes.
And if you're trying to tell people about the thing that you have, you have to somehow get access to that finite resource that other people also want. And this is what advertising is all about is. And this is also why it's so fucking expensive and why it's so competitive and why it actually creates business to business warfare. And the end result of that for a particular combination of product and market could very well be that it is absolutely not worth it. And what we have found for us for making premium games, especially trying to sell them in the mobile space and where in particular, advertising is extremely expensive because of how much it has been driven up by AAA and by mobile free-to-play titles, that advertising in our space is so expensive that our business model is not compatible with it. It just can't work. Yep. And it's especially in the context of where we can get free promotion, actually, so I guess a 30% of our cut resulting in quote-unquote free promotion, right? By getting featured on the stores, that's not a process we control. It's a random process.
The question really is after you launched a game, whether it does well or does poorly, how would you feel if you could have spent some money on advertising but didn't in both of those scenarios?
Well, this is a FOMO, right? This is a FOMO problem, right? Which it's a dangerous way to think because that only still works if advertising works, right, in the first place.
Oh, yeah, I know. But this is to me more so the – back to your point about almost the placebo effect on the business team.
Yeah, which is exactly. This is why people do it because they're afraid if they didn't do it and they look back.
If sales are bad and you're in a meeting with the boss – and the boss is, you know, just chewing people out, and why are our numbers so bad? And then the boss points to some chart that's like advertising expenditures zero.
What the fuck is that about?
And then he's getting like, what's going on with this? Why didn't we advertise?
It's the beauty of being in the advertising industry, right? Is that it's like selling snake oil or anything else, right? Like some snake oils might do something, you know, who knows, right? But because there's no way to know, there is no way to know if the advertising spend was the right move, then if you don't do it and things don't work out, you can attribute the failure to not having ads. If it does work out and you did buy ads, you can attribute the success to having bought ads.
Well, you can. You can't justify it, but you can attribute it.
Right, you can't attribute as in like that was what happened, but as in you can believe that's why. Yeah. And there's no way to prove otherwise because there's no way to know, right? And then finally, if you're successful and didn't spend advertising dollars, now you can think, oh, maybe would have been even more successful had we bought ads, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no way.
There's no.
I just want to.
There's no way to discredit it.
I just want to point out here that every time I've seen a movie in the theaters, you know, in the before time, every time I've seen a movie in the theaters, as I am sitting in the chair before the movie starts, I see a 45-second long Coca-Cola advertisement.
Yep.
Every time. Mm-hmm. I am already in the chair. I am not going back out to the concession stand to buy a $17 Coke, right? And also, I don't go buy a Coke at all, anytime.
Anyway. I have not bought a Coke in like 15 years.
Once the world was plunged into a global pandemic, I began buying caffeine-free Diet Coke to mix with my rum. That was the catalyzing event that caused me to start purchasing Coca-Cola.
Yeah, and it's because you had Coke before. And so, because we grew up, our mom was always stocking Diet Coke. Like, we just had Diet Coke in the fridge all the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? So that's why today you drink Diet Coke. It's not because you've
seen – Well, no. It's actually just because I know of a drink called rum and Coke, and I didn't want to drink straight rum.
Yeah, yeah. But then the reason – sure. But even the idea of going to buy Diet Coke for that purpose and so on, right? It's not because you're – because the point that you're making is it's not because you're seeing those ads.
But I guess I would disagree because the trailers for other movies come up before the movie, and that in the before times was also the way that I would be like, oh, shit, yeah, I'm going to go see that one.
Yeah, but again, this is because context matters, right? I think the idea – the idea that ads just do or don't work is just wrong. It's a nuanced thing that has to do with the industry, your product, and your market. But I think it is probably the case that for – because the things that we're pointing at are movies and car dealerships. The things with these high margins and so on, right? And they actually have a small number of products, right? There aren't a lot of car companies. There aren't a lot of cars. There aren't a lot of dealerships. There aren't a lot of movies, right? These are very finite. I think once you get into the space where there's a fuckload of stuff, right, where there's a lot of competition, I think the default stance should be that advertising is probably not worth it, because that is the space where it is the most expensive, because there's so many competitors in that space, right? And so that is the space where the margin is going to get as close as possible to zero, right? But because advertising has to be a faith-based act, right, buying ads, then that means that there will be people who spend more money than they can possibly make on ads, yes. Which means that the net effect is that you can only buy ads at a rate that you cannot get a return from.
Yes, which so I think is what you've seen in the mobile space. Yeah, the mobile gaming space in the last two or three years has definitely breached into that, where they're like, yeah, it's like an $8 cost per install. I'm like, the fuck?
Yeah.
In what? In what world are
– how can you possibly make – right. And the only way you could do it is if there's a way for someone to spend $1,000 so that they can subsidize the other people.
But even then, I guess – I don't know. It's
hard. Wait. You know that what? It's 2% of people spend money on a mobile game on average, right?
Yeah.
So if each install costs you $8 on average, mm-hmm. then that means you need to be making $400 per paying user average.
This is the thing from in games industry. I think last year they did that big breakout where it was the cost of advertising to get a single paying user into your game.
It was
$32.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
It's how much are they going
to
be paying?
User has to spend $32 on average just to break even.
Yeah. Just for you to not go bankrupt.
Yeah. There's no way the average – I mean, maybe I'm just out of touch with how much money some of these games in the upper echelons make. But the idea of the average spend for a free to play game being $32 just seems a bit.
Well, but I think a lot of what you're also seeing, because we're talking about the direct, you buy a user and that user spends money. When I say buy a user, I mean that's what you refer to as mm-hmm. user acquisition. Give them an ad, you spend money, and then they come in, so you call that buying user. So you do that. But the other thing that you can do if you spend enough money is push your game up to the top of a chart, right?
Yep.
And then the side effect of that is that you now get free advertising because you're on the top of a chart, right? And by free, I mean – because obviously you spent money to get there. But I mean you didn't pay directly for that thing. And I think that's actually where an enormous fraction of eyeball value, right, for the games industry comes from is from tops of charts. And so you might spend a fuckload of money to get up there and a lot of money to stay up there, but now you actually have this this feedback effect, right? Where the cost to get into that echelon is astronomical and most people can't afford it. And it's also extremely risky because if you don't get all the way up there, you're not making that money back. Yep. You just threw that money away, right? But if you do and you can stay up there, then high enough up there, right? So if you can spend enough, and this is kind of our hypothesis with even like with Levelhead, was that advertising at a low level doesn't do anything and can't. And what you actually need from advertising in our space, in the game space, is that its purpose is if you can spend enough money
to burst yourself up
to get into the organic stuff, then that's actually where the value comes from. But the cost of doing that, like, so if you're just going for like pure user acquisition, that's the goal. It is just not tenable in games.
So what you're saying here, Adam, if I can kind of like really compress this into a diamond, you know, is that the companies that make money off of advertising are psychological arms dealers.
Yes.
Playing both sides of the conflict that Absolutely. They created.
Right.
So, because think about
it. It's even worse because the fucking app stores themselves sell ads, right?
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, through their own searches and stuff like that. Yeah, because if you think about it, what are some of the most profitable companies in the world? We're looking at like Facebook, Google, Apple, right? I don't think Amazon is one of the most profitable because their margins are very tight, but I think
they do move an enormous amount of money though.
They do, yeah. But
also, do they advertise? I can't even think of having seen an Amazon advertisement. They just are where you go. Everybody, like, that's just how you buy things.
Well, as you walk around, you see their boxes at everyone's, you know,
porch. That's true. Or, yeah.
You know,
so every delivery is an ad. Yeah.
The real winner here, because, you know, people talk about, like, oh my gosh, like Candy Crush made like $2 billion, but they spent $500 million on advertising, right? Well, there's a lot more Candy Crushes out there also spending $500 million on advertising every year. So the real winner here is just whoever owns the billboard and has convinced both car dealerships to bid against each other, because it's like, well, now that this billboard is up, like, you got to spend the money. I put the billboard up.
It's a prisoner's dilemma situation.
And now this is your problem, right?
Well, then it gets hilarious again, because like as anybody who's gone to GDC before as a developer knows, you can't throw a rock without hitting an advertisement company, a new one. Right.
I wish I could throw rocks. To be honest.
Yeah. Like,
the number of dead end conversations I've had because of that was just.
Oh, yeah. That's hilarious. But now we have these. Now advertising companies also need to. They're competing against each other for the advertising dollars, right? So
they need to advertise at GDC to convince everybody else to advertise on their platform. Right.
So now you get this, like, it's just layer on layer on layer. And of course, that means they have very high overhead because they're spending all their money on advertising against each other in order to sell more advertising. Like, the whole thing, like.
Yeah. So the problem here is, like, it's like the nuclear proliferation problem. It's like, if everybody just didn't, then this would not be a problem. But of course, because if any one person decides to drop even a penny to put their car dealership on that billboard, then somebody else is like,
we now got to drop my penny.
Two pennies.
If I drop two pennies, then I can get their name off that billboard and put my name on that billboard. And then boom, 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 suddenly it's $40,000 to put your name on a billboard.
For questionable reasons, yeah.
And nobody really knows even whether it works, but you could definitely say that at least it's not the other guy's name.
Yep. That's how I feel about advertising.
There you go. That's how I feel about advertising.
Okay, well, I think that's probably all the time we have for this week then. So we'd like to thank our producers, Fat Bard and Jen Coster, for putting the podcast together. And thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord running. To get more involved in the Butterscotch community, go to podcast.bscotch.net. We have links to the Discord, a way for you to donate, and links to the podcast archives. Thank you all for listening. We'll see you next week.
Goodbye.
Bye.